If I were to announce right now that at 4 p.m. today, I would give away $4 million at Yonge Dundas Square in $10,000 increments, what would start happening about 5 minutes from now at the square? What if I said the money would only go to deserving people, but in the interest of political correctness, I would not, and I'm going to repeat this, I would not require anyone to prove that they were needy, that they qualified? Would there be an orderly lineup of the most needy and honest people waiting for me at 4 p.m. on the square? Well, you know the answer. To be clear, I'm not going to do that, well, because I don't have the money, but I wouldn't use yours. And what sort of idiot would do that? Well, I'll tell you what sort of idiot. Justin Trudeau, Andrea Horvath, and Toronto City Council. All of the above have trumpeted Canada as a sanctuary for people walking illegally but uncontested over the border with the USA to get your money. And Friday, the mayor of Toronto held a press conference, and as reported in The Sun, flanked by three of the socialist councillors who perpetuated the shelter crisis, that would be Joe Crisey, Anna Bylaw, and Joe Mihevic, Mayor John Tory indicated to reporters that 40% of the shelter system's beds are currently being used by refugees, and if this influx keeps up, it'll be 50% by November. Last fall, it was 25%. He also warned that if the province and the feds don't provide financial and resource help within the next 7 days, he will be forced to open an emergency reception center within a local community center to accommodate their arrival. Anyone with two brain cells to rub together could have told you, and indeed did tell you, that this would happen. It was as obvious as is the pandemonium that would be created if I were to start giving away large sums of money on a pre-announced street corner. Sue Ann Levy was at the press conference, and she writes, "When I suggested that perhaps Tory should have been more careful what he wished for, he got testy with me," she says, "insisting that what has created Toronto's shelter crisis are unbelievable circumstances way outside the borders of our own country that all of us can't imagine, and we represent part of the solution," Tory said. "With all due respect to my friend the mayor, he's wrong. Those people are not coming from unbelievable circumstances. They're not refugees we as a nation are helping rescue from desperate circumstances. They're coming in from the USA. And according to Canadian law, by international agreement, they're already in a safe country and have no right to cross our border without asking permission and going through the process. We have a homeless shelter crisis in the city. We're spending massive amounts of money and leaving legal residents out in the street because politicians can't and will not follow the law and common sense." Justin Trudeau's a trust fund baby who's so disconnected from reality and cause and effect that he may in fact be incapable of understanding how dumb he is, so I hesitate to say shame on him for what he's doing. NDP leader Andrea Horvath has pledged in her platform to make Ontario a sanctuary province. She would allow Americans to hop over the border and get health care at your expense under her proposal. She's not stupid, so shame on her. Mayor John Tory and many others on City Council in Toronto have loudly declared the city a sanctuary city. By doing so, they've devastated the shelter system as we pay to house people who have no legal right to be here. Shame on them. Rather than beg the feds for money, Tory should use the big pulpit of the mayor of Toronto to demand that the federal government uphold Canadian law. On the panel today, Randy Rahamin, principal at Navigator, with a focus on management, design, execution of public affairs, Rashid Clark, communications coordinator and freelance writer, and Jennifer Innes, regional councillor, wards 3 and 4, town of Caledon within the region of Peel. Jennifer, you're the elected official here. Am I being too hard on elected officials? And is Caledon a sanctuary area?
I wouldn't say we're a sanctuary area, but we do have some. For example, I know that one of our local church groups has partnered with one of our Rotary clubs and is taking in a Syrian family as we speak.
Okay, but there's a difference between having refugees and just saying we're going to give out services to anybody who comes, walks up and demands it.
And part of the problem in Peel in particular is we, you know, we like to say, and I agree, we don't get our fair share. We house, we take lots of, whether it's refugees, newcomers to Canada, and if you're familiar with Peel's demographics, English is predominantly not the first language, and we have a shortfall in being able to provide the services that our residents need to be successful and to thrive and to be part of our fabric in our community. So given the fact that we can't even support our own at this point in time, not having the programs and the funding in place to support others coming in makes it extremely difficult, especially for Peel, because when it doesn't work in Toronto, guess where they're going? They're crossing over to Mississauga, Brampton, and that becomes Peel's problem.
Randy?
Yeah, but this is a our government, our federal government, has decided to allow refugees into Canada, wherever they're coming from. And so because of that, municipalities have to step up and help out. And where are they going to go? If you're a refugee...
Wait a second. Can you defend letting people come across the border uncontested from the United States and then just dumping them onto the systems in the cities, specifically Toronto?
Well, they're treating them the same way they do a lot of the other refugees that come in, quite honestly.
Yeah, but, but can you defend that?
Look, whether or not I personally agree with the way that border issue is being handled, they're letting them in. So what's the city supposed to do? If you're a refugee, you're attracted to the largest cities because that's where you know that there's more likely, you're more likely to get a job, you're more likely to get support, you're more likely to find people of your own community. So they go to the large cities. So now we've got this problem from the federal government. The city, John Tory's right. He has to step up and help in some way. And
no,
so 40
he has to step up and protect the taxpayers of this city for a change.
Maybe, but also, Jerry, how much influence is he? What's he going to do? Oh no, big bad Justin Trudeau. We can't do this anymore. Please enforce our laws. In the meantime, he's got to support the people that have come to our city. And so I think, you know, my family, quite honestly, were refugees at one point in time. We had help from people that probably sat around and felt the same way. And so I think that's just part of our culture to some extent.
That's squishy liberal kind of rhetoric that doesn't mean anything in terms of the law.
The issue, though, is that we're already having a housing crisis.
I agree. It's not
ideal. We're already in a crisis situation, and now you're compounding it with even more.
Yeah. You know what? Whatever the mayor is supposed to do, I don't think people elected him to give up and be part of the problem. We'll find out what Rashid has to say about it coming up. Thanks for being along on the panel today, Randy Rahamim, Rashid Clark, Jennifer Innes. I started out on the 908 talking about the shelter crisis that we have in the city of Toronto. 40% of the shelter system's beds are currently being used by refugees. The thing is, we have gone a long way from what we understood to be immigrants and refugees. I think we have to have an orderly immigration system, and refugees, every country, should probably step up and do what they can to help people who are in devastated countries, people who are in fear of death in their own country, etc. But we have people just walking out of the United States into Canada, not only totally unimpeded, but we actually send our border guards over to help carry their suitcases. It's terrifically ridiculous. And you can see the damage being created right here in the city of Toronto. And yet we've got a city council that still calls it a sanctuary city here in Toronto. Andrew Horvath threatening to make Canada a sanctuary country to the point that people from Windsor can come here for free health care. It's out of control. Rashid?
Well, I think something that Jennifer touched on earlier, I think capacity is the main issue here. And if you have church groups, you have local families that are willing to like take people in, that's great. And then we can actually provide the support. But when it all comes down to shelter systems, there just isn't enough capacity. And then we are dealing with our own homeless who are unable to get in. And above all, it doesn't solve the problem in the original countries where a lot of these people are coming from. I mean, I know that's a much bigger issue to tackle, but if we just say, okay, everyone come on over, you're not actually addressing the issues as to why people are leaving countries in the first place.
Yeah. And again, this is not in my comments are not anti-immigrant or anti-refugee, but these people are not refugees. It's my comments are anti-government who can't seem to even take the time to figure that out.
But Jerry, what percentage of the people that we're housing here, the 40% of refugees that are taking up that are using our shelter system, are they refugees from other countries? Or are they mostly refugees from the United States?
Well, it's
that
both.
Would be interesting to
it's
know.
It's both. But we've had tens of thousands of people come across that border from the United States into Canada, and an enormous number of them want to come to Toronto. A bunch of them are in Quebec, and Trudeau's answer was not to uphold the law. His answer to Quebec was, don't worry about it, we'll send more of them to Toronto. He literally said that. All right. Earlier, I'm going to talk about this study that came out about millennials wanting their own backyards. And we were trying to determine who on the panel is a millennial.
Me.
Millennial. They have a new name.
Cusp adjacent millennial.
They have a new name, Randy.
You've had how many 39th birthdays?
29.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm not there yet. Where I celebrate my 39th with happiness.
All right. Jennifer, you're on the edge. Is that it?
I guess.
Like, are you a millennial or are you not?
You have to be 34.
I am not a millennial.
There you go.
But I'm a zennial, whatever that is.
I was told this morning that in some, like it's 34. I said it's 34 and somebody said, no, it goes up to 38.
No.
Depends on who you talk to. Some people have different interpretations from
millennials. If that's your interpretation, I'm only one for one more week. But it's not. And I don't identify myself as a millennial. I always identified myself with Generation X. But apparently I'm a zennial, which is
A zennial.
In between millennial and Generation X.
Yeah. I'm a boomer. I'm here to devastate your healthcare system. Dad, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay.
And I am an actual millennial, okay. Even if you go by the under 34 definition.
Now you're just bragging.
I just barely got in under the cut. But
you're trying to make Randy feel bad, and I long ago gave up on it.
You're so good at it, though, Jerry.
At what?
Making me feel badly.
Oh, I'm sorry. So the story was Toronto area millennials want their own backyards. So starting with the millennial here, do you live in a house? Do you live in an apartment up in the sky?
I live in an apartment in Mississauga. It's a wonderful one bedroom, and I'm honestly very happy there. I don't see a particular need to go to the house to get the green grass, to get the backyard. You know what? I've heard a lot of people sort of, and I see right now almost looking at me like, I'll change my mind. But I've heard a lot of people already say the same thing about me and like having kids. I'm not one for children myself. And I've heard a lot of people tell me, oh, you'll change your mind about that. And so far I haven't. And so far
I'm smiling because I think it's your mom's. Is it your mom's one bedroom apartment? Like,
no,
are you living with your mom?
It's my own.
Okay,
one
good.
Yeah. No, I actually did move out on my, I'm a big boy millennial now.
Oh, okay. So
we try to avoid panelists who still live with mom.
Okay. Hey. I live on the farm.
She lives with
my
mom.
Parents.
You live on the farm. Yeah, I know, but you're like the Waltons. It's just like the whole multi-generations are living in this house surrounded by cows and horses.
Which is amazing.
Yeah. So Tim Hudak, who is with the real estate people here in the province, he heard me say this morning on Moore in the Morning, this study, Toronto area millennials want their own backyards. And I said, I don't care. Do you want to hear what I want? Like, you know, I don't care what they want. And he wrote back and said, no, the point of the study is that millennials want a home, yes, but we need to move on housing supply. Otherwise, prices go way up. They move or they commute long distance. 500,000 more household formations over the next decade is what we need if millennials want a house.
But if they really want a house, they will move. They will add the extra hours to their commute. It comes down to what they actually really want in their lives. And you know what? We only have so much space that we have within the city of Toronto to build and the area surrounding the city. So we are left with a crisis already in terms of housing. And if people want houses, then they're going to have to find them outside the city.
Well, we have areas in the city that could be developed, I'm told. But Randy, should we, in a city that's growing at the rate that it is, should we be developing single family homes, or do we just have to give up and realize that we're going to have to be like New York and Tokyo and start building more condo buildings?
I think it's a little bit of both, quite honestly. And I think that, you know, what's funny about this study is I think you need to balance what we want with what we can afford. And so as prices, look, I want a pool. That doesn't mean that all of a sudden I'm going to get a pool, right? I might need to work a little harder, change. Maybe I need to move out of the city. Maybe I, you know, there's lots of things I want that I can't afford. I think that we are increasingly moving to a city where in the downtown core, we're primarily building condos and that we're going to have to move further and further out to get some of the, to get some real estate. But as you said, boomers are going to be moving out of a lot of the houses that they currently own too. So there's going to be a bit of a flip, I think, in the housing market.
But the problem is that they can't afford, if they want to stay in the same area, or the same community that they're in, they can't afford to actually downsize because the cost of the downsizing is equivalent to the cost of their current home. So for example, in my community, you sell your house for $1 million, you want to buy a bungalow for something smaller, it's $1 million. So yeah, you're downsizing in size, but you're not downsizing in cost, and it becomes impossible. So baby boomers are staying in their houses a whole lot longer, and they're holding on to these 3-4-bedroom homes that they no longer need because financially it's the only way that they can stay in their community.
So we're expecting a lot of warm weather this summer. We're right in that season now where it's really warm during the day and then it gets chilly at night. So you should be wearing a pair of Newstalk 1010 gym socks to bed to keep your feet warm and yourself attractive to your partner. A look at the summer forecast. Who objected to that?
That's a stretch.
It's a stretch goal?
Okay, yes, that's right. On the panel today, Rashid Clark is here, communications director and freelance or coordinator. You're not a director, you're a coordinator.
Thanks for giving me the promotion, but
yeah,
no, didn't take
it. Well, if it was up to me, you'd own the company.
Thank you.
All right. And freelance writer, I guess you own that.
that is my thing.
Yeah, you got that going for you. All right. Jennifer Innes, Regional Counselor, Wards 3 and 4, Town of Caledon within the region of Peel. And Randy Rahamim, Principal at Navigator with a focus on management design, execution of public affairs. Just before we get into some of these topics we're going to talk about, there was an interesting little conversation going on in our prep room between two moms on the show as they were talking about kids taking the EQAO tests today.
All week, Jerry.
All right. And Jennifer, you seem to have an issue with the prep that was going into this.
I just think, you know, the purpose of it is to test the curriculum, to test the schools and the ability and making sure that our children are learning and at the level that they're supposed to be at. It's not actually testing the individual child. Why are they practicing so much? I mean, my daughter has been talking about this for months now. They've been taking test practice runs. They've been, you know, she's asking me questions at home. She's wanting to practice at home. And I just find how legitimate is the results actually going to be? And what saddens me is the tests, like they're in grade 3, but we already know that we're behind the eight ball when it comes to the math scores for grade 6. How much prep did those students have before they took that test? And those scores were still that low.
Yeah. Well, the prep, I would assume, Randy, is to try to make up for the fact that we're not doing well on math scores.
Is it, or is it? I think it's a way for schools to compare themselves to each other as well, right? So I think that, you know, on some level, the teachers want their classes to do well. The schools want their own schools to do well. This could be more competitive. I think all of the schools, quite honestly, the vast majority prepare for
them.
They
all prepare.
And you know what? I'm not so opposed to that, because preparing for them means that they're getting the kids ready with the curriculum. They're like aggressively teaching this curriculum. I feel like we've been preparing for this for months. And then I asked my son today what 9 times 7 was. And he's like, how am I supposed to know?
You know what he should write?
I'm a little concerned.
If he gets that question, he should write, I already told my mom I don't know this.
Well, and in fairness, I think, too, a lot of these kids have never taken like a test to this type of extent, right? Like they've never sat down, you know, most of their test is, you know, 10 word spelling bee kind of thing. It's not, It's not as intense as what they're going to get today. And so maybe part of the prep is that. But I also think you have to draw the line between preparing them for how to take a test and testing and reinforcing the knowledge that they have.
Well, it's a lot daunting for kids to be taking a test that is this big, because I remember when I was in school, I never had any kind of test like that. Everything was very focused. Like, you know, your math test is your math test, your spelling test is your spelling test, whatever. And it didn't matter how I compared to other people in other schools and other districts. It was just, how did I do against my friend Robert beside me? And that was the extent of it. And it feels like it's a lot of pressure on kids. And I was like, oh yeah, we have to, like, you know, raise the profile of our school. Everyone get together.
I don't think they
here.
Know that. I don't think that they're aware of that. And in fact, our school's done a really good job to minimize the stress. Because I think in previous years, there have been a lot of parent complaints about how intense it was, considering they're in grade 3. So I think that they're pretty easygoing about this. My boys certainly weren't stressed about the EQAO today. They
knew they're trying to make it fun, right? Like, my daughter every day has something. Like, today is bring a stuffy day. One day is pajama day. So they're doing something special every day to sort of make it fun for
the kids.
So
wear your pajamas while you do the test.
Next Tuesday on the panel is pajama day.
Right.
For Jen. Actually, it's onesie day, Jen.
Okay, couple of responses by text message here. Somebody writes, we went through this last year with our daughter. We told her, don't worry about it. The test's really not about you. It's about the teacher.
Right. And do they release the test scores? Like, do they actually tell you?
Test scores.
But they don't tell us, like, what your own child's score is.
And the question you quizzed your son on was 9 times 7? Yeah. Was that it? Someone on text message has helpfully sent in 63.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, because we were all puzzled. Canadian students owe $28 billion in government loans, and some want the feds to stop charging interest. These people have made it all the way through university, and they don't seem to have an understanding, Rashid, that it actually costs money to lend money to people. And another reason for the interest, they're saying, oh, well, they're just making a whole lot of money off of this. It's to protect against the fact that some of you won't pay back.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is fair, but I think some of the interest rates were higher than what some people are getting for their mortgages now. So it does seem a little bit unfair for students who are just starting out their careers and just starting out of school to all of a sudden be saddled with so much debt, especially when we got back to the earlier topic of they want to have houses and all. I mean, we're not going to let people do anything that they would like to do in their lives if they're already saddled with debt.
Well, guess what happens when you borrow money?
You have to
pay
it back
with interest.
But how much interest? I mean, I think maybe the idea of scrapping interest entirely, scrapping interest entirely probably doesn't make sense, but it could at least be lowered so something a little bit more manageable for students.
Why?
So that
the
they can do something
between
with their
a mortgage,
life.
Though, and a student, if you're qualifying for a mortgage, you probably have a job and you're making an income, and it's a lower risk proposition to lend you money. Whereas if you're a student, there's no, you know, they have no,
there's
nothing
no collateral.
To, there's no collateral, right?
That's
so
right,
it's a
yeah.
higher risk loan.
I would loan you money if I had any to loan. I would loan you money on your house at a lower rate than I would lend you money just on your freelance writing, for instance.
You haven't seen my writing, though.
Well, I don't care. The house is just, you know, it's got value.
But the point, too, isn't just to pay back, you know, or to compensate for those that don't pay the interest. It's also to allow them to continue to lend in the future. That money goes back into yeah. continuing the cycle of lending for that next year of students.
That said, I was one of those students that had student loans and had a really tough time paying them back for a very long time. So I feel these people's pain. And I think that I agree with Rashid that there's got to be a middle. There's probably something in the middle that works better.
Wait a minute. Are your student loans paid off?
Yes.
Do you have a house?
Yes.
Got some kids?
Yes.
Good job.
They don't earn 9 times 7, though.
No, but what I'm saying is, oh my gosh, you actually became a grown-up. And that's what they need to do.
So you think that we should never change the rules because the rules applied in previous generations?
I think people should stop whining about having to fulfill an obligation they signed up for before they got this money. That's what I think.
I think you can always look at the rules, too. I remember when I was going through, I had student debt, too. But I remember after my first year, I couldn't get it because my father was self-employed. He's a farmer. I mean, like, the rules changed, and then all of a sudden, so then I had to carry my own debt, which it is difficult to pay off. But I think that, you know, you can't make it interest fee. That's ridiculous, because then how do you pay that back?
And that wasn't, I'm not suggesting we make it interest free, but I think a lower interest rate than what is currently on offer.
Anxiety lands. This is from the CBC. As WestJet pilot strike looms. Now, this is a bit of a problem if you've got tickets on WestJet for your summer vacation, wondering whether or not that's going to happen. But I don't understand what the issue is. I mean, I'm hearing how pilots are so hard done by. But I went online this morning, and according to, I think it's called glassceiling.ca, they discover what various professions make, that all in with base salary, profit sharing, the kinds of things that they have at WestJet, Rashid, the average pilot makes about $125,000 a year. Does that sound like their poverty wages?
Sounds pretty good to me.
Okay.
I think they could probably pay back their student loans pretty easily.
No, I don't know. I mean, okay, let's put it in perspective. These are people, men and women, who have your life in their hands as you're flying through the air. So is $125,000 too much? I don't know if that's... And anyways, is that what they're fighting about? Is it just total wage? Or
well, that's
is
what
it right?
Is it a wage issue? Is it a working conditions?
Thanks for being along on the panel today. Jennifer Innes is here, Rashid Clark and Randy Rahamim. Barack and Michelle Obama found a new job. They're becoming television and film producers for Netflix. Not exactly sure what kind of shows they're going to do, but they're sort of hinting that these would be shows about people who have, in their opinion, made a difference. The one thing I would look at with this, Rashid, I have no idea what kind of shows they're doing. Haven't seen any of the shows, so I'm not going to predict whether they'll be good or not. But I go along with one of the people in the article here from the National Post saying, you know, the biggest deal in being a producer is to get your calls returned. Well, I think they can probably do that. I think they can probably attract money. They probably will be fairly effective producers.
Absolutely. I think they can attract money. They might have some very good stories to tell. They might have some very good documentaries lined up. I just don't know what those would be. And it did kind of strike me as a little bit odd that all of a sudden they're striking up a deal with Netflix because they never seem to have any real interest in the sort of entertainment side of things before. And that was the little bit of a strange thing for me.
Okay. But and they're not going to actually, Jennifer, direct these things or act in them. They're producers, which means they're attracting scripts and ideas and money.
Well, and I think who better to have be in a position to have heard lots of different stories, to have seen or heard of lots of different experiences, and helped them shape who they are and the decisions that they've made. And I think the point to having their calls returned is absolutely correct. They're, you know, either one of them calls you, you're going to return their call. So I think that they're in a good spot to be a producer. But I just find that the story is interesting, that it doesn't give really any detail. it's just announcing the partnership kind of between, you know, the Obamas and Netflix.
They're going to make TV shows. What kind of shows?
We don't know.
No one knows.
Who knows? Are they going to have their own?
Documentaries.
We don't really know what it's going to be. I think it would have been nice if there was a little bit more meat to the story.
I think they've long had a fascination with Hollywood. I think they've always, they've invited them to the White House. Their daughter, I think it was Malia, interned for Harvey Weinstein. Like they've got connections.
Really? I want a documentary on that.
That'll be the first one. But I think that I think it's wonderful because number one, it's good for both of them. Number two, it's a way for him to get his voice out, for him and her to get their voice out. And people want to hear from them. They've been pretty quiet since Trump's been in office. They haven't really offered much by way of criticism. On certain things, maybe, but not very much. And I think this people want to hear from the Obamas.
Yeah, I can't imagine that anybody who is the kind of person who already does or potentially might put money into the creation of a documentary or something like that is going through all of their requests and is like, oh my God, people won't leave me alone. Oh, Barack Obama called. Better call him back.
Right.
You know that's going to happen.
100%. And they're going to team him up with probably great content producers who are going to present opportunities and, you know, it'll be a big success.
It works that way in any kind of endeavor. If you look at sports, for instance, Rashid, you're running a hockey team and there's a hot prospect out there. You're not sure whether he's interested in your team. And then you say, we can get Bobby Orr to call him.
And then
okay.
You're calling. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. If that doesn't exercise the kid, it'll certainly get his dad going.
Absolutely. But I mean, I think it does open the door to a lot of potential of storytellers, filmmakers, that they might be able to get their product out there a little bit easier through the backing of someone like Michelle and Barack Obama than the regular Hollywood brass.
Yes. I think it's a kudos to Netflix.
This Sunday from the Obamas. All right. This idea started in California, in Silicon Valley, and so we may see it here soon enough. We already have the rent a bicycle program or whatever that's called, the Bixie Bikes. Yeah. And then, of course, there are various temporary car rental kinds of things that you can do just out of your condo building or whatever. Rental electric scooters disrupt California's economy and its sidewalks as well. They're saying it disrupts the economy in that they just leave these scooters around and people can just jump on them. The city hasn't even approved them and they're just saying, we don't care. We're putting them out there anyway. You walk up, you see the scooter there. You have an app on your phone. The app unlocks the scooter. For $1 to unlock it and 15 cents a minute or something like that, you wheel down the road to wherever you want to go, and then you just get off the scooter and leave it there right in the middle of the sidewalk.
With a helmet on, right, Jerry?
Well, you're supposed to wear a helmet, apparently, when you're on one of these scooters in the city, but people aren't doing that because they don't happen to have a helmet with them. So they just hop on the scooter. Would this be a good thing for Toronto, Randy?
I think so. I think it's kind of cool. And I also think what makes these things attractive is the way in which they're introduced, the disruptive element of the way they're introduced into a particular community. The fact that they didn't get the proper licenses, maybe they did that, maybe not that far, but that all of a sudden 1,000 electric scooters show up in a particular city, and the fact that they don't have a docking station, they don't have a place where you lock them up, you take them home and leave them in front of your house. And I think that's pretty cool. But at the same time, how would that work in Toronto? Like maybe that would work in the downtown core. But if I took the electric scooter to my home, who's going to be walking by and be like, I could actually use that. I think I'll...
Somebody with the app.
Yeah, I just think it's unlikely
that some random person
is going to be on my residential street and be like, hey, I really need that electric scooter now.
Okay, but they started it up in California, and Rashid, one of the problems they're having is people just get off and leave it in the middle of the sidewalk, or people are riding around on the sidewalk, which you're not supposed to do. It's shocking that people on two-wheeled vehicles aren't following the law. But
if we're talking about how it's going to work in downtown Toronto, I don't know how it can actually work in terms of people moving around on the sidewalks, or do they get on the street and then add to the traffic and the bicycles? Like, people just aren't going to be able to get around. And above all, to me, it just strikes me as lazy that people require an electric scooter to go a few blocks. Like, why can't you just walk?
I think it's in place of a bike, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't use them on a sidewalk. It's definitely...
So you can't use them on a sidewalk. You go out onto the street.
You go on a bike lane. And you have to go on the bike lanes. 25 kilometers an hour. How fast does a bike go? Probably the same.
The problem
with me. Why are you all looking at me?
You're all looking at me about how fast the bike goes.
How does the bike work at the farm, Jen? We don't have the motorized bikes. You actually have to pedal.
No, you know how they get around? Giddy up. Let's go. Rent a horse.
Don't laugh. We do use a horse.
I love horses, but they're just kind of impractical in the city. And would the police please clean up after their horses? That's what I would like to see happen.
Do they not have bags?
No.
Like doggy poop bags? I don't think it's
big
enough.
So like a lot
hanging
of horses
the back end of the
have
horses.
A bag.
Yeah.
Imagine they have to dismount the horse and go pick up the poop.
Well, okay, but you're
And that doesn't always happen, but it is nice, especially when it's along our trailways.
Well, yeah, but the police in the city, they don't do that. We're scolding people. Properly, we're scolding people who don't pick up after their dog. And if you came into the city on your horse, Jennifer, I think you would be expected to clean up after your horse. I don't understand why the police...
Not your high horse, your horse.
And I've never been able to get an answer to that as to, because I've asked this before. I even asked some horse professionals and they didn't understand why. We couldn't.
What are you getting upset about now? You're getting upset about random horse poop, like when the odd horse walks through the city. How many horses are walking through the city?
I had 60 seconds left and no time to start a new topic, so I threw that in, Randy.
When in doubt, go with poop.
What's that?
When in doubt, go with poop.
Oh, the poop cafe. We can talk about the poop cafe again.